Welcome to Podcast on the Brink, your weekly dose of Indiana basketball news and discussion, brought to you by the Assembly Call and Inside the Hall. I'm your host, Jared Morris. Join me live at assemblycall.com every Thursday night and immediately following every IU game for our live IU postgame show. And visit insidethehall.com for complete coverage of IU basketball and to join the discussion in the Inside the Hall premium forum.
Continuing with our every other week schedule right now for Podcast on the Brink, with a lack of actual sports in the collegiate landscape to talk about, but still plenty to discuss off the field and off the court, and to help us make sense of the last couple of weeks, we welcome back Zach Osterman of the Indianapolis Star to Podcast on the Brink. How you doing, Zach?
Hey, good to be back.
So it's a weird time for those of us who are who cover college sports. For you right now, you'd be getting ready for the first IU football game of the season. That's obviously not going to happen anytime soon now, but off the field, there's been a lot over the last month. We've had earlier this month, I believe, the Big Ten had a announcement of a schedule for football, only to come out, I think, five or six days later and say they weren't going to play. We've had parents protesting the decision. We've had a lot of players speaking out against the decision. We've had some school presidents in the Big Ten being willing to talk about the decision. We've had others not. Just from your perspective, how do you kind of analyze and grade just the Big Ten in general, how they've handled this whole situation? Obviously, the approach has been more proactive than the SEC and the Big 12 and the ACC in terms of, you know, kind of saying that we're going to postpone. But in general, you know, I think fairly the Big Ten's taken some heat for how they've handled the situation. Just how do you kind of summarize and your thoughts on how they've kind of managed the whole situation so far?
Yeah, I think the two things I sort of find myself saying up front in whenever we talk about this, number one, remember that what got us here was the virus. You know, none of this is happening without the virus. You know, that is the underlying condition here. Number two, this is absolutely one of those situations where we will not know until we have the benefit of hindsight who was right. And that's, you know, if the SEC and ACC and Big 12 play a college football season with, you know, minimal disruption and no real catastrophe, then we'll look at this and say, hey, the Big 10, the Pac 12, they were, you know, too cautious. They, you know, they were too careful and it cost them. If, as I think some people still suspect, we get to, let's say, mid-late September, and the climate around college athletics is such that, you know, those three Power Five conferences that are pressing on, you know, decide to say, hey, we just can't do this, then we'll look back and say whatever the process issues, the Big Ten made the right decision, and they made it early, and therefore they made it in the absolute best interest of their athletes. How it has been handled is another story. And I think that the biggest issue, really, more than anything else, like there's stuff about it that's sort of window dressing. Like when people, for example, complain about the release of the schedule, then cancellation a week later, I've said many times they needed to release the schedule because they needed to give teams the green light to start fall camp. While they clearly still were not prepared to make a final decision on the season. But the glaring issue has just been the lack of transparency and the lack of explanation. You know, Tom Allen, we talked to Tom Allen on a Zoom call Thursday, and he wasn't particularly critical of the Big Ten. You know, he wasn't flying off the handle. He wasn't, you know, it wasn't some sort of Scott Frost level airing of grievances. But he did say something that I think summed the situation up well, whether he intended to or not. He said that in his experience, When there is a lack of communication, what rushes in to fill that void first is negativity. And that is what you've seen. And it's, you know, the Big Ten kind of had a blueprint. The Pac-12 released, you know, summary documentation with its decision saying, this is why we came to this conclusion. Here are the things that we're citing, the studies, the information, whatever. You may not agree with it, but this is our stance. This is our position, and here's why. It took the... And, you know, it when Kevin Warren finally did sort of release that open letter, it was a two-page letter. It explained the Big Ten's decision. It was all the reasons you would have imagined. It wasn't like anything in there was a galloping shock. But it opened Warren up to a new round of criticism. And I think, you know, listen, I think this has been a bit of a trial by fire. I think this whole year, frankly, has been a bit of a trial by fire for Kevin Warren. You know, I understand why the Big Ten did not necessarily think they needed to hire, you know, let's say like a mid-major conference commissioner to be their new conference commissioner. But it was basically the worst possible year to A, replace Jim Delaney, and B, replace him with someone who was going to take a little time to really get settled into the way of doing things in college. I actually think, and this is not so much to absolve Kevin Warren of criticism as to point out he's not alone in this boat. And I've written this. He needs more support than he's getting from his presidents and chancellors. You know, that we've heard that the vote was not unanimous, but it was, you know, there was an overwhelming consensus, quote unquote. He's been the one that's kind of had to go out there and sell it, but it wasn't his decision. This comes down to the COPC, the Council of Presidents and Chancellors. And yet when there was this outcry for explanation, basically, no one really did anything. I think in the first day or two, Michigan State's president released a statement on social media, and that was about the extent of what I saw. And you know, the sort of the overarching point here is you can criticize Kevin Warren, but the COPC picked, and they're the people that have empowered him to run the conference, and they're the people, therefore, that he needs the most support from. The idea that he would just walk into that room and tell them how they were voting is a gross misunderstanding of how that relationship should work and does work. And frankly, even worked with Jim Delaney when Delaney had been at the Big Ten for ages. So nobody has, you know, really kind of covered themselves in glory in this. I know there are some parent protests outside Big Ten headquarters this morning as we talk on Friday, the 21st of August. You know, one way or another, it does feel like we can close the book now on this. By and large, there will be no fall sports in the Big Ten. Only time will tell us whether that was the right decision or not. It has not been a great episode for a lot of the conference's leadership, but I'd also say, particularly given that you're talking about a first-year commissioner who has spent the majority of his tenure thus far trying to run the conference in the midst of an unprecedented global pandemic. I think this can potentially be more instructive than destructive to kind of everyone's long-term interests in the conference, if that makes sense.
Yeah, Zach, I think you brought up an important point and one that I may have missed. Actually, as my dog starts barking here in the background, the beauty of podcasting from home during a pandemic, the dog may bark in the background at any time. But Zach, you brought up an interesting point there about Warren and just kind of the fact that he's been really thrown under the bus for his handling of the situation when in many ways it may not be his decision to make. You know, it's the chancellors and presidents that ultimately do make that call. So, you know, some of the reaction to what he is, how he has handled this, I think has been a little bit unfair. But from an IU specific perspective, I think one of the things that's been a little bit frustrating for me, and you kind of alluded to this on Twitter earlier in the week, you know, I believe you've asked for comment multiple times from the president's office just in terms of just kind of some insight on maybe, you know, what the thinking was in the decision. You haven't gotten any response. And yet we have a situation now where IU students have come back to campus, and I think just less than 12, 15 hours after there was some videos that circulated on social media of students congregating, you have Michael McRobbie sending an email to the student body, kind of admonishing them for their behavior. What do you kind of make of the unwillingness of the university leadership to make any comment on the athletic standpoint of this? And are you surprised at all that there's not been at least just a statement or some kind of explanation offered?
You know, I think yes, and in one sense, no. I mean, I have requested comment through this process in the last 2 weeks, I think four different times from Michael McRobbie. And it's worth pointing out that is not just because Michael McRobbie is a Big Ten president. He's also the immediate past chair of the COPC. He's on the, I think it's called the executive committee of the COPC. He's one of the longest tenured presidents in the conference. You know, he's someone who would have a significant voice in that discussion. I think, you know, it's worth pointing out he's also not alone. And, you know, this is something that I think is particularly the Big Ten is distinct in this way from many other conferences, not, you know, necessarily all, but bar Northwestern, every school in the Big Ten fits pretty much the same profile. They're all big state schools, land grant schools. Everyone except Nebraska is in the American Association of Universities, and Nebraska actually was and then got kicked out, voted out, kicked out probably is a little bit of an exaggeration. You know, the point is these are all people whose salaries are ostensibly paid with public money. And, you know, to suggest that they should not have to address this publicly when this affects a lot of people's lives and livelihoods, and there are a lot of people who want to know more about this decision-making process, you know, I don't think that's particularly fair. What I would say, and this is another area where I go back to saying, I think this should be more instructive to the conference than destructive, is I'm not sure that in the past, we would have necessarily done this, but I think that's because Jim Delaney would have had a better handle on basically how to manage this from the beginning. And that just comes down as much as anything else to Delaney's time on the job, to his relationship with the university presidents and chancellors, and to his standing in college athletics, all things that Kevin Warren really shouldn't be criticized for because he's only been commissioner since January. You can't just make Kevin Warren a 7-year veteran of the Big Ten overnight. He has to have the time to do that. And of course it's been terribly unfortunate for him that, you know, his first year winds up being probably the biggest challenge of his tenure. So you really are just like thrown into the deep end with lead shoes and asked to swim. It's incredibly difficult for him. And I think that not that you should sort of just be giving everyone a pass for, you know, every decision that goes wrong or isn't explained or is unpopular, but do remember the position that he's in. And the position that, you know, he's trying to navigate the conference through. And so then that's where it comes back to this idea that I think if this happens 5 years ago, the presidents maybe don't really talk much. Maybe the chair of the COPC, and I have not seen a statement from Morton Shapiro, the president of, or I don't know if he's a president or a chancellor, but the head of Northwestern. It's possible he has talked and I just haven't seen it. But you know, 5 years ago, Delaney looks at this and says, okay, you know, I help you understand the nature of this decision. You all make this decision. And then as commissioner, as the most public face of the Big Ten, I take it out and sell it. You know, I go out and I basically present and back our decision because that's part of my job. And I think Kevin Warren, has tried to do that. I think, you know, I don't want to put words in his mouth. I don't know if maybe he's underestimated the degree to which, you know, people would demand more of an explanation. I'm not sure. But that's where it sort of comes back to this idea that I think his presidents and chancellors needed to be more aware of, well, listen, this is, you know, his first really big moment in that job. And, you know, we need to be there to support him if anything, if there's anything that needs supporting. Because it just, it, again, I think people have become so accustomed to the Big Ten seeming like the most sort of functional and harmonious conference in the country. And it probably was, at least at the Power Five level. But that's because Jim Delaney had been around so long that he had the relationships and the cachet, and to some extent the political power as well, to basically keep everyone, you know, everybody's oar in the water and pulling in the same direction. Kevin Warren, people have criticized Kevin Warren saying, well, he doesn't understand, he doesn't have those relationships and this and that. Well, of course he doesn't. He's a first-year commissioner. You know, if this was his seventh year and this happened this way, you'd look at it and say, well, geez, what's going on in the Big Ten? But it's, you know, he hasn't even been on the job 12 months. He needs that time. And in the interim, he needs the support of the people around him. And I just don't know that he's gotten it so much. And listen, on the one hand, I understand why individual presidents, maybe Nebraska notwithstanding, and I keep making, you know, backhanded reference, I should probably stop. But I understand why individual presidents would not want to speak out of turn. And would not want, because what you don't want is what happens when, let's say, Nebraska, you know, comes out and says all these things and all of a sudden it throws the conference into chaos. Our team's going to try and break away. Our team's going to just sort of play their own season. What does that do to the conference's harmony? What is it, you know, is that even allowable under conference rules and on and on? So I understand in one sense, the presidents would not, presidents and chancellors would want to speak as one voice. But if you see your commissioner with this and you know it's his first, you know, it's his first big crisis and it's going to be difficult to navigate and it comes with myriad challenges, you know, and we have absolutely no blueprint for how to deal with something like this in you know, modern history, in modern Big Ten history, that's where you need to step up and find a way to be more supportive. And I think that applies to Michael McRobbie. You know, I think, frankly, it applies again to all of them. And particularly not to dismiss Shapiro at Northwestern, but his is a private school, particularly the presidents at the big state institutions. You know, their salaries are paid with public dollars, at least at the most fundamental level. And therefore, if there is a significant enough public outcry for explanation of something, I think they're owed that. I think that's fair.
I think it's fair to say one of the biggest concerns for Big Ten coaches from a football perspective is the ramifications if somehow the ACC, the SEC, and the Big 12 have their season and move forward and find some level of success with it and are able to complete the season and have a playoff that doesn't include the Big Ten. What do you feel the long-term ramifications for the Big Ten would be if that becomes a reality? Is it something that's going to have a lasting impact, or do you feel like it's, you know, something that can be easily overcome in the next in the foreseeable future?
That is the $64,000 question that if I had a perfect answer to, I'd make a lot more money than I do right now. It would be damaging. There is no question about that. It would be damaging, obviously, to the Big Ten brand, and I suppose to the Pac-12 brand as well. You know, it would also be damaging. I mean, I'm working on a story basically asking what sort of financial arrangement can be made between the broadcasters and the conference when you have this dynamic where the broadcasters are now not getting what they're paying for. But on the other hand, it does ESPN and Fox no good if the Big Ten is financially crippled. So, you know, that's probably going to be some sort of negotiation to figure out how that money flows. You know, do ESPN and Fox still front the Big Ten some money just to help, you know, keep the departments running and everything, you know, somewhat copacetic while the Big Ten figures out how to make a winter season work. Well, guess what? That's a totally different conversation if the SEC, ACC, and Big 12 wind up playing full seasons. And ESPN can say, well, you didn't do that. You know, if everybody cancels, then the Big Ten's position is clear. Hey, you know, we all tried. Yes, we moved more quickly, but that's because we wanted to be more cautious. We are committed to trying to figure out a way to play in the winter or the spring, but we need you to work with us. And ESPN says, yeah, well, you know, nobody can make it happen. So we'll work with you. We'll figure this out. It gets more complicated if, you know, just financially as well as anything else, if those three conferences can complete a season. And it is worth saying, too, as we kind of discuss this in a lot of different ways, the general public sentiment right now basically seems to be that if any one of those three conferences shuts it down, they all will. That we're basically at kind of the last breaking point, so to speak. But the damage, listen, it's not like the Big Ten would become a second class citizen overnight. The Big Ten still has Ohio State. It still has, you know, I mean, it still has some of the most like fundamental strengths that any conference could have. It has massive alumni bases. It stretches from the Midwest all the way to the East Coast. It touches many of this country's largest television markets. People are still going to tune in to see Michigan, Ohio State on the Saturday, the Saturday afternoon after Thanksgiving. Like that's always going to happen forever. So it's not like the SEC is just going to quash the Big Ten if that happens and you know, the Big Ten's days are numbered. But it would be damaging. There's no doubt about that. It would be very difficult for the conference to move, I think, financially and also in terms of the optics, frankly, of a lost season that maybe didn't have to be.
So shifting gears a little bit, Zach, you're in Bloomington and students are beginning to return to campus. I know there's been a pretty comprehensive COVID-19 testing program put into place. We've seen, I believe, a couple other Big Ten schools already kind of go online only after some issues. We've seen already, as I mentioned earlier, a situation in Bloomington, some video on social media where IU Bloomington felt compelled to respond to some behavior from the students that I guess was deemed unacceptable. However, I would kind of counter that with, as somebody who's attended IU Bloomington, and I'm sure you can speak to this as well, being on campus in Bloomington, there's going to be a certain segment of the population that's just not going to adhere to the social distancing aspect of it. And there's going to be people that want to go out and kind of do what they want. And that we've seen that in all parts of society throughout this pandemic. So what's it been like being in Bloomington, seeing students come back? Have you noticed kind of a change in terms of just how the city operates, traffic and things like that? And what do you kind of think of how things are going so far? It seems like to me, and I haven't really hidden my feelings on this, but you know, this whole decision to bring students back obviously is driven a lot by the financial aspect of it. And I wonder, from a practical standpoint, are we setting most of these students up to fail, just because the whole notion of being on a campus, especially one like IU's and a lot of these other large state schools where you have tens of thousands of students, it to me just doesn't seem like a viable strategy to stop a transmission of COVID-19 when you've got people living in dorms and fraternity houses and congregating like they are.
Yeah. I mean, listen, I've heard criticism too, and I kind of maybe sit on a middle ground between it, but I certainly understand where it comes from, the idea that you would be calling off sports but bringing students back. I do think, like, using Indiana as an example, I do think Indiana has made a good faith effort to try and make this work, and it may it may well be impossible, may well prove impossible, both because of behavior and also just because, as you said, it's just, you got to put students in dorms, you got to put students in Greek houses. It's, you know, you're going to wind up in situations where it's going to be incredibly difficult. Like, I mean, I lived in a fraternity house in college. How do you serve food in fraternity houses? I mean, it has to be buffet style. Like, you cannot, you would, you, like, half the house wouldn't eat if it was made to order. But it still creates this, you know, this sort of perfect cocktail of disease vectoring. You know, I mean, spend 20 minutes on a college campus and you'll come into contact with all sorts of different colds and flus and different things anyway. You know, Indiana has tried to stand up a substantial testing program to the extent that it at least had plans for an on-campus test processing facility. It was hoping to test as many as 10,000 people a week by the saliva test. You know, it's testing everyone who's coming back to move into any on-campus housing, which I believe includes Greek housing, and it has dorms set aside for quarantine, you know, for students who become ill. They go, I think it's Ashton over on the east side of campus, or whatever that is, west side, north side, I don't know. It's just hard to imagine it working. And then, of course, you know, you see these scenes, and Indiana's not alone in this. We saw it at Alabama. You know, I think there were suggestions of it at Notre Dame. I know Purdue has suspended, I think, more than 24 students already for violating social distancing policies and things like that. You know, listen, without wanting to be crass, you know, when I was 19, I can't tell you I would have acted much different, you know, if my friends had a party, or, you know, my girlfriend invited me over or whatever. I can't tell you I would have acted too terribly different. I think there's even, you know, to some extent, and again, I don't want to speak for a large body of people, but I think there is at least a, you know, sort of a prevailing concern that students are just taking the attitude that this isn't going to work. And so they're going to try and have some fun with their friends now, knowing that they'll probably all just get sent home and, you know, college will get shut down before too long. It is just very hard to see it working, you know, and what's going to be fascinating, just from a college sports perspective, let's be clear, I'm not talking about, you know, public health, but just from a college sports perspective, as we talk about that, is now we have bubbles, or at least relative bubbles. If campus is shut down, your athletes don't have to co-mingle with the wider population. Of course, they still may, you know, they still may have parties or whatever, but you can at very least get yourself to a place where it's down to their personal responsibility much more so than it is about having to attend class, having to attend lectures, labs, whatever. And so maybe then there's a better chance at playing sports. But then you get into all sorts of ethical questions about whether or not basically the NCAA's amateurism mission is really being served if you're playing sports when classes aren't in session. We're coming up against quandary after quandary, but I think that the biggest one for higher education is just going to be that, as you say, it's exceptionally difficult to imagine a scenario where this, you know, this works for any length of time.
So the next kind of thing that I think is on the radar for both of us is what's going to happen with college basketball, because, you know, at Indiana, it's unique in college sports. You know, it's one of the, you know, handful of programs where basketball is the king on campus. And you know, there's been a lot of discussion already. Dan Gavitt's, you know, given multiple interviews to Andy Katz and various folks about just kind of all these contingency plans. I think that's been encouraging from the standpoint of it looks like the NCAA, and I'll say that right now, looks like, because we have no idea what exactly is going on behind the scenes. We've seen nothing in terms of a plan. But it looks like they're being a little bit more proactive than the conferences were for college football. in many ways was rightly criticized because, you know, they had all this time to figure something out, and some of it obviously is dependent on just the virus and the situation there, but it also kind of looked in many ways that, you know, they thought maybe it was just going to go away and they'd be able to operate business as usual. You know, the hope is that college basketball is coming up with something a little bit more concrete on what they're going to do and contingency plans. From where we sit right now, and I think you'd probably agree with me, Zach, I see no way that we're starting in early November with a college basketball season. There's no real way to justify having all these bye games, these preseason tournaments, like, say, the Battle for Atlantis or Maui, where you have basically destination games where you know, a lot of it's fueled by tourism and getting fans there. For that reason, I am a little bit intrigued by some of the discussion. You know, Mark Emmert mentioning a bubble, Dan Gavitt saying, you know, we're going to do everything we can to get the NCAA tournament played. What are your just kind of thoughts on when you can see? Obviously, they've kind of given us mid-September as a date where maybe we'll know some more about kind of what the plan is. But what do you see as maybe the most viable and strategy for getting a season started? Do you think it's conference only? I'm asking, kind of putting you on the spot here to kind of see the future, but I'm just kind of curious what your thoughts are as we kind of move into this next phase. And at Indiana, it's obviously the something that a lot of people are going to be interested in is what this college basketball season looks like.
Well, I think, you know, I think you're right about football. I think football, again, made a good faith effort. And in fairness to football had absolutely no blueprint, you know, to operate with. And football is also just a different animal. You're talking about a lot more people. I mean, just like, you know, 5, 6 times, 7 times more total individuals that need to be kept around a program and kept safe and kept sort of sequestered as much as possible compared to, you know, a football program. Basketball will get the benefit of seeing what worked and what failed for football. And that was always going to be the case, of course, by the virtue of the calendar. And so I think you can maybe have a little bit more hope in a basketball season. You know, it was interesting. Archie Miller floated the idea of, like, could there be conference only from Thanksgiving weekend? You know, I mean, you mentioned the Maui Invitational. I don't know what Maui's doing. I probably should reach out and ask. But, like, Stanford's in the Maui field. Stanford's not playing basketball till 2021. The Pac-12 has already called off all sports for the rest of the calendar year. Now, the Big 10 hasn't done that yet. But the point is, when you talk about non-conference seasons, you know, many of them are already busted up. And you know, I think what you're probably going to see is the big conferences move to conference-only schedules. Maybe you create exceptions so that Louisville can still play Kentucky, or, you know, IU can still play Butler in the Crossroads Classic, something like that. But that would be probably about it. You know, I don't see, you know, just call it an educated guess, but I don't see anything beyond that at this point in terms of non-conference. What I do think people should be prepared for is the NCAA to take a much, much more active role in this than in football. And that's for a couple of reasons. One is structural. Since the early mid-80s, the big football schools have been sort of siphoning power away from the NCAA with regard to football. Obviously, the NCAA, you know, organizes rule structures and enforces recruiting guidelines and those sorts of things. But, you know, football is as a sport, in the way that it is scheduled and played, is constructed almost entirely by the conferences. They negotiate their own television deals. You know, they, along with the sponsors and the networks, the broadcasters, negotiate most of the bowl field. You know, they are responsible for the, you know, basically the sort of year-to-year execution of a football season. Basketball is still the NCAA's domain. The NCAA tournament is an NCAA championship. It is run by the NCAA, and it is what makes the NCAA money. I mean, to the tune of, like, I think I want to say maybe $900 million last year, something like that. Except not, well, excuse me, 2 years ago, year there was no tournament. And the NCAA had insurance to cover that. to a point. It did not make up for all lost revenue. It did make up for some, but the NCAA can't afford a second canceled tournament. You know, that's just what this comes down to. The NCAA needs to find a way to play the tournament because for financial and I guess possibly political reasons, and this may be me going out on a limb a little bit, but when we talk about the between the Power Five and the NCAA tournament is still one of the big cards that the NCAA has in its deck in that struggle. And you start to lose that, you know, does that push the Power Five even further away from the NCAA? Again, I might be out over my skis a little bit there, but more than anything else, the NCAA just needs to find a way to have a basketball postseason, men's and women's as well, because that's where the vast majority of the association's budget comes from, as well as certainly its political power. It lost that last year. Everyone understood why it lost that, of course, but to lose it 2 years in a row, I think would be very, very damaging. So basketball has always been, not always, but you know, certainly in kind of our modern context in college sports, basketball has been the Big Ten's, you know, sort of corner of the store, so to speak, much more so than football. So do not be surprised when you see the NCAA taking a much more active role in basketball. It's not because they weren't prepared to lead on football. It's not because they weren't interested in leading on football. It's because this is the area where they have a lot more power and authority.
Do you have any preference from just a logistical standpoint in terms of having a conference-only season, trying to play some non-conference games? I mean, in terms of equity when coming up with a tournament field next season, to me, it would seem to create a lot of issues if you're going to play conference-only games just from standpoint of figuring out who's deserving of making the tournament. I mean, you know, the baseline every year for how we kind of view the leagues going into conference season is what they did in a non-conference. And if you have leagues just playing themselves, I don't know exactly how that sorts out. How do you kind of view the format of the season, and is there any importance in your mind to try to get some of those non-conference games in, or should the focus be mostly on just trying to do this in the most safe way possible and figure out a way just to have the tournament if that means not playing non-conference games? And do you have any thoughts on, you know, to talk about these bubbles? Do you think that is, you know, there's been some people that have come out and said, well, if there's no way it can work, you're doing this with unpaid athletes, and there's other people who think, well, you know, Mark Emmert has actually mentioned it. So to me, it seems like something they're actually discussing. Do you think that's at all viable?
It's clearly on their minds. I've said since the spring that I think the idea of bubbling athletes would create a serious challenge to the notion of amateurism. And I mean a legal challenge. I mean a lawyer somewhere wanting to approach someone about challenging on legal grounds the idea of amateurism if you do that. Now, you know, maybe in their most candid moments, leaders in college athletics would say, well, listen, you know, this is the direction of travel we've been on for a while here. We're starting to basically be forced into a corner by Congress on NIL and you know, athlete welfare and compensation. So maybe the solution here is just to sort of rip the Band-Aid off and, you know, go forward. And we'll figure it out as we progress, but let's survive this, you know, catastrophe right now. And then as we come out of it, we'll look at reforms that, you know, frankly, we're probably kind of being forced into by political and public sentiment anyway. I think with regard to the structure of the season, the first thing you've got to do, you've got to work backward. Like the first thing you've got to do is decide, what's the NCAA tournament look like? Because when Mark Emmert was talking, I think he was talking to Andy Katz in an interview that was published on NCAA.com, you know, he was saying, well, if we do a bubble, 64 teams would be difficult. That's a lot of teams to put into one quote-unquote bubble situation, but maybe we could do 32. We could certainly do 16. So the first question you have to ask is, what do you want the tournament to look like? Do you want it to be like four bubbles of 16 teams? And then four teams come out of those pods, and then you send them to another bubble, and you play a Sweet 16, Elite Eight, Final Four, National Championship game over the space of like 2 weeks. You know, maybe even less than that. And when you lose, you're out of the bubble. I don't know. But that's where you need to start. Because if you're going to have, let's say, a 64-team field somehow, well, then you can probably sort of adapt our more traditional system of you know, picking teams, you know, maybe even just say, hey, what we'll do is we're just going to take the net, we're going to take KenPom, we're going to take KPI, we're going to take BPI, and we're going to take RPI, and we're just going to average them all together for 1 year. You're in if, you know, we're just going to pick based on averages, and you're in if that, whatever. You start paring the tournament down, then I think that's where you could potentially get into saying, well, we're going to need an automatic qualifier from every league. You know, the league champion, regular season conference, we'll figure that out. They get an automatic qualifying bid. And then maybe from there, we're picking, you know, a few of the extra at-larges and acknowledging up front that it's likely that, you know, with one or two exceptions, it will be a very sort of high major heavy field. But you've got to, I think the first thing you've got to figure out is what is the format of your tournament? Do you even build almost like a section of the tournament that's just for mid-major schools? I don't know. But I think the first thing you got to do is figure out how you want to structure that thing and then work backward from there to be able to, you know, sort of communicate with your schools. So I think that's going to be the other thing too is, and again, something maybe we've learned from the Big Ten struggles in the last couple of weeks, you're going to need to communicate. Don't leave ambiguity for coaches because they will complain about it. And because you also need to, you know, I think this is almost a season where it would frankly behoove the selection committee to come out before the season started and say, listen, we have sat down, we've had a series of virtual meetings. We have decided these are the criteria by which we will be selecting the field. And so, you know, go forward accordingly. So coaches can't have, you know, can't sit there and wonder, well, will it be our road record? You know, will it be our losses? Well, I mean, like, I think it's a year where the selection committee could be justified in saying, like, you know, the first thing we will do is, you know, consider all teams with no more than two KenPom top, you know, KenPom 101 plus losses. And then we'll move through all those teams, and then we'll go down to this, and then we'll go down to this, and we'll go down to this. But I think there needs to be as much clarity as possible because there's really just not going to be any way, if there is no substantial non-conference season, to be comparative in this. You know, the Big Ten is probably the toughest it's been in 7 years right now. So if, let's say, the Big Ten winds up playing a 24-game league schedule with or let's just say a 26-game league schedule, total round robin from the weekend after Thanksgiving, everybody plays everybody home and away. Plus, you get, you know, two non-conference games or one non-conference game, whatever, if you want it. Well, you know, yeah, if Indiana comes out of that 15-13, then it stands to reason Indiana should be in the tournament. But then you probably are going to have some team in the Missouri Valley that, you know, runs a table and goes 23-3. And everybody's going to say, well, why aren't we letting the team that's 23-3 in? I think it's a year where, like, you need to be more upfront about how the field's going to be structured, certainly, but also, frankly, how it's going to be picked than you've ever been before. This can't be one of those years where you get to the end of the year and you say, okay, well, these seem to be the criteria that fit this field the most, and that's how we're going to judge these teams. I think it's almost got to be one where the selection committee comes out up front and says, this is what we'll be looking for. You know, these teams get auto bids, and then from there for the bubble, this is what we'll be looking for because it is just going to be so difficult to cross-compare this season.
Zach, we appreciate the time. You can follow him on Twitter at Zach Osterman. Read his work in the Indy Star. Subscribe, by the way, to the Indy Star. At IndyStar.com. Zach, always good to have you on the show. Thanks for your insight, and hopefully we'll see each other at a basketball arena this winter at some point. That'd be good.
Yeah, who knew how much I'd be missing Iowa City right now? But
yeah,
if I could walk into Carver Hawkeye and cover a game, I absolutely would. It's you know, it's a strange time. You know, I can think back to when we called everything off in March, and we, you know, we thought, well, we're going to be doing this for a few weeks, and here we are, what, 6 months later. 5 months later, I've lost track, and there's, it's not that there's no end in sight, but it's certainly not like we're going to be walking back into stadiums tomorrow. I'm jealous, frankly, of, you know, and I don't know if we should be playing high school sports or not. That's another ethical conversation, but I am a little bit jealous of my colleagues who are covering high school football tonight, because there's I think very nearly nothing I'd rather do right now than just walk into a stadium and cover a game and have everything seem relatively normal for a couple hours. But we'll get it back. We'll be eating those Chick-fil-A sandwiches outside the press room before long. So thanks for having me, as always.
Maybe it might be good for us if we go a little bit more time without eating those Chick-fil-A sandwiches. It might help us a little bit.
I won't miss the mystery meat in the press box at IU football games. That's for sure. I will not
Can't say I've ever sampled the mystery meat. So
it's definitely meat like product. That's for sure. Ribs, meat like product. Tacos, meat like product. Yeah. If you team up with JD Campbell, you can sneak up to the sixth floor and grab what's being catered to the suites. But most of the time, it's the dodgy looking hamburgers down on floor five of Memorial Stadium.
Thanks, everybody, for listening to this week's episode of Podcast on the Brink. As I've kind of said the last couple episodes, we're going to stick with the every other week schedule for right now. And so we'll see you next month for another episode of Podcast on the Brink. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and have a great weekend.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Podcast on the Brink. We always appreciate you being here. Remember to join me and my co-hosts for more IU basketball talk at assemblycall.com and visit Alex over at insidethehall.com for complete coverage of Indiana basketball. If you want to support Podcast on the Brink, here is the single best way to do it. Tell anyone you know who loves IU hoops about us and suggest that they subscribe. Podcast on the Brink can be found on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and everywhere else podcasts are available. Tell your social media followers, email your friends, text your family members. For weekly discussion about IU basketball, they need to be subscribed to Podcast on the Brink. We'll talk to you next time. Go Hoosiers.